were rumors running amok through the community about devil worshippers.
You have to have a certain amount of rage in your system in order to take a body apart, piece by piece by piece.
There are monsters who live among us capable of doing this kind of thing.
James lit up the room, never in a bad mood. Can't even picture him yelling at someone.
We had concern that this wasn't the first one.
The motivation wasn't money, it wasn't drugs, it wasn't sex. It was far deeper than that.
It was just not done to kill the person, but destroy this person's image.
A shocking murder becomes a dark mystery. The victim's body holds the key to convicting the killer. Every fiber is a clue. Every wound is a piece of the puzzle. In these cases, it's up to the medical examiner to find the crucial evidence and catch the murderer. This is Secrets of the Morgue.
Racine County is relatively rural. There's farms, there's horse farms. There are plenty of churches. Religion is a very strong part of the community here.
We're 20 minutes from Milwaukee and 60 minutes from Chicago. This is really a quiet community.
Late one summer morning, a farmer notices something strange at the end of his field.
An individual thought something was funny because the cows were all sniffing the air and gathering on the other side of the fence, and they didn't know what was going on. In the ditch were two large yellow plastic trash bags.
I remember the bags as being yellow and industrial, almost like what today we would call contractor bags.
When he was trying to pick up the plastic bags, he discovered it was a human being.
Lieutenant Ivanovsky responds to the scene.
Inside one of the bags was an upper torso, and inside the second bag was a lower torso. And somebody had cut the head and arms off. I had never experienced anything like that. Nothing since like that either. Very gruesome.
When all you have is body parts and you don't have a cause of death and you don't have a mechanism of death, a homicide investigator is left with a lot of questions that don't have answers. And the first thing you have to do is to identify that person, because that will start to give you some answers.
The remains are sent to Milwaukee County Medical Examiner, Dr. Jeffrey Jensen, for autopsy.
I think the most important part of it is closure for that person's life and closure for the person's family and to know what happened. At this point in my career, this was the first body dismemberment that I had examined.
The first step for Dr. Jensen is to determine whether he's dealing with one or two victims.
We have the lower portion of the body in one piece. Then we have a torso that has had the head and upper extremities removed. We can match body parts up based on the known number of lumbar vertebrae. Those two pieces were comparable and compatible in every way. It was a younger male body.
The matching lumbar vertebrae prove the remains are from a single victim. The body also reveals a deeply disturbing fact.
The individual had been emasculated, then the external genitals removed, and I was not able to identify any hemorrhage related to that. So it would be my opinion that it was most likely a post-mortem emasculation.
Dr. Jensen looks for a way to identify the young male victim.
We were still relying on old technology, fingerprints, and dental examinations to make identification. Back in 1990, DNA was expensive and not available to most medical examiners. We had no fingerprints, no hands or upper extremities in this case.
Lieutenant Ivanovsky and his team are determined to discover the identity of their victim and catch the perpetrator capable of such evil.
The level of hurt or damage done to both this individual and his family and the community called for action by police. Obviously, it's protection of the public.
Police start by canvassing the area around the crime scene.
I have to conduct what they call a neighborhood check or a near area check to see if there's possibly anybody else in the area that might have seen somebody put the bags there, might have seen a suspicious vehicle in the vicinity, might have known anybody that's missing. The houses were very distant and very far apart, where we were going 2 or 3 miles away from our crime scene. We check all of the missing person reports, checking with all of the farms nearby, all of the subdivisions nearby, all of the cars that we could find and the people in the area, and nobody could identify or knew anything.
All you have is a scene is where the body is found. That may be a secondary scene, it may be a tertiary scene, but it isn't the murder scene. So you don't have the information and evidence that would flow from that. You don't have an identification of the victim, so you don't know whether they're from 10 miles away or from 25 feet away. All of that are first steps that are very difficult for an investigator.
While investigators speak to local residents, a strangely unnerving tale begins to emerge.
Someone complained that he had like 5 dogs disappear in like 10-year period, and none of the dogs were old enough to just die on their own.
Several residents report disturbing events happening within the county.
And there were several people that pointed out that their other neighbors on one side or the other of them possibly were having Satan rituals in their barns late at night or early in the morning.
The people that lived outside the city of Racine certainly aren't used to violent crime generally. And this kind of violent crime was incredibly scary. And there were rumors running amok through the community about devil worshipers. People that do believe in God and belong to traditional religions, they can be terrified by people they believe worship the devil.
That's possibly the reason that this individual was cut up into body parts. They were doing a Satanistic ritual of some type.
Police are wary of rumors. But then, Dr. Jensen finds sinister cuts on the victim's skin.
There was a peculiar pattern of stab wounds that was present over the midline portion of the back. The stab wounds were vertical up and down and also horizontal. There may be a pattern there. This was some kind of a message or some kind of a symbol.
We had to investigate and talk to all of these people and see if, in fact, some of this stuff might have really been going on.
In a small town, a case like this can send people into a frenzy. And oftentimes, people will assume that the only people capable of this are members of a satanic cult or some kind of deviant group. And that's often an attempt to try and make sense of something that seems so far beyond the realm of human possibility. But in reality, there are monsters who live among us.
All of the neighbors who had been pointed at as being Satanistic told us freely that, yes, they had parties in their barn till early hours of the morning, but it also included beer and whiskey and wine, and nobody did anything illegal. We had no information on the identity of the individual, nor were we getting anywhere to begin with as far as identifying him and finding out what actually happened to him.
Investigators continue to speak to residents, hoping for a lead.
Racine County Sheriff's Department. I had several investigators and several deputies literally going from door to door. And we had expanded our search from probably 2 mile circumference to about a 5 or 6 mile circumference. One of the deputies was actually parked on the side of the road making notes in his notebook about whom he had contacted already and whom he had interviewed and what type of information he had gathered. And all of a sudden, the dog came running down the middle of the street with a human arm in its jaws. It was in a totally different area from where the other two body parts had been found. We thought perhaps we now had a better idea of where the crime occurred because now we had two locations, and it might have occurred in the middle of these two locations. So now we moved our circumference of search into a different area. We brought in the City of Racine cadaver dogs.
As the canine unit combs through farmland, police confront an ominous possibility.
One police dog found several other body parts.
Unbelievable. Just horrific.
Investigators fear there could be more dismembered victims scattered throughout the county. Detectives are investigating the murder of a young man when the discovery of more body parts leads them to believe there could be multiple victims.
The deputy that was there to this day has nightmares about seeing that dog running with a human arm in his mouth.
Soon after, local residents make another shocking discovery.
A man and his son were walking down another county road, and they came across a head lying in the drainage ditch. To find a dismembered head anywhere, which is just horrific. They called up the sheriff's department, and of course we had another crime scene at that time. So you have to cordon off the area, you have to search and see if there's any other body parts in the vicinity, you have to pick up the evidence and ship it up to Dr. Jeffrey Jensen.
It's up to the medical examiner to determine if these body parts belong to the dismembered man or if there are multiple victims.
When we're investigating a case like this, we're trying to ascertain whether we're dealing with one victim or possibly multiple victims, what we call commingling of skeletal remains. And so as body parts are coming in, we're able to lay out the body pieces on an autopsy table. We approximate them into a reconstruction of the individual. We're looking for matching parts that are consistent in sex, age, and race. This articulation was consistent with the torso on the neck structure and on the lower pelvic area. We were confident that the body parts were from the same individual.
News of the discoveries quickly spreads through Racine County.
We had phone calls from everybody in the community saying, could it possibly be my son? Could it possibly be my cousin? Could it possibly be... Everybody was telling us that it could possibly be somebody that they haven't seen for a long while.
At the morgue, Dr. Jensen uncovers a potential clue on the victim's skin.
On the right upper shoulder, there was a intact tattoo that indicated the Grateful Dead tour from 1988. So we'd take a Polaroid photograph and release that to the law enforcement, who could then look for that individual.
It's not long before a concerned parent contacts police.
The victim had known tattoos on his shoulder, and that his father was able to look at that.
Once you have a suspected person, you can inquire about dental records to help identify the individual.
Dental records confirm the dismembered body is that of 24-year-old James Michael Madden.
When we finally identified the victim as James Michael Madden, it opened up a world of information to us. His friends, now we knew, his coworkers, his family, and we could interview and talk to all of these resources in order to find out if they had any information that would help us prove what happened in the homicide.
Investigators look into the life of James Michael Madden.
He was from Milwaukee. And he seemed to be a nice young man, going door to door trying to sell in magazines and make some money.
They track down his girlfriend, Allie Winkler.
James, he lit up the room. He was very friendly, trusting, never in a bad mood. Can't even picture him yelling at someone. Just someone that was very nice to get to know.
Lieutenant Ivanovsky questions Allie about the last time she saw James.
The day that ultimately was his last day, one of my cats had a birthday, and when he was leaving, at the landing on the steps, he looked up and said, "Don't forget, I still have Bogey's birthday present." And so that is the image that I picture. The last time I verbally spoke to him.
Investigators learn that James then left for work that morning. They speak with his fellow employees.
There was an organization called Citizens for a Better Environment that James Michael Madden worked for, and they were brought down to Racine County in a van and dropped off. And each one of them had an area or a path marked on a map that they were supposed to go door to door and try to sell magazines.
By nightfall, James hadn't returned to the van for the ride back to Milwaukee.
Jim never came home that night. So I went out looking for him, and I was keeping close contact with his parents, and for like 3 days it was just not knowing anything. And then that Friday night I was watching the news and they said, "Coming up, body parts found in Racine." And I was holding a TV guide and I just dropped it, and it's like I just knew.
Detectives turn to the medical examiner to see if the pattern of violence done to James's body might offer clues about who did this to him.
Part of what a forensic pathologist does is to interpret injury patterns and injuries, the presence of hemorrhage or blood into the surrounding tissues would imply that the person is alive at the time that the injury occurred. In this case, we found an abrasion around the ankles. I made an incision into the skin of the abrasion and was able to see a hemorrhage, so that confirmed that it had occurred prior to death.
The injury points to another disturbing clue about the circumstances of James Madden's death.
There was upward angulation that might suggest some suspension, but that's all I could ascertain from my examination.
The anger involved in dismemberment homicide is just beyond comprehension. Somebody was really in a rage in order to do this, because you have to have a certain amount of rage in your system in order to take a body apart, piece by piece by piece.
In cases where there is overkill, where the victim's body is mutilated and it makes them almost unrecognizable, investigators will see that as a clue that this person had extreme rage in a way that is above and beyond what we typically see in many homicide cases.
The thought that came to our mind is that he knew the person who killed him.
James Michael Madden lived just outside of Milwaukee. Lieutenant Ivanovsky widens the search into the city.
They were doing a canvas of the friends and people that might have known James Michael Madden.
As they knock on doors, local police learn of something strange close to where James lived.
They received information that an individual that living in the city of Milwaukee had what they call as a diorama. And inside this diorama, with these walls and rooms and furniture, were little miniature people. And these figures were dismembered.
The level of anger behind the mutilations instantly raises investigators' eyebrows.
Some of them had no arms, some of them had no legs, and they were bleeding.
Detectives question the motive behind the diorama's design.
made it look like this had been an extreme homicide case. And it triggered somebody to say, who could think up something like this?
Detectives are searching for James Madden's killer. A strange diorama found near his home is their newest lead.
One of the very thoughts that we had when the diorama was discovered was that the killer, he was memorializing an actual crime, or maybe more than one crime.
Investigators wonder if the disturbing creation is somehow linked to Madden's brutal murder.
When you get an emotional kill or an overkill or a frenzy kill, it's someone that you could have killed with two or three stab wounds, yet you choose to kill them with 45 or 50 stab wounds. You've gone far further than is necessary.
It was awful, very baffling. We looked for any similarities to the cuts in dismemberment that we had in Racine County, and there were similarities.
Investigators now look for any connection between the creator of the diorama and the victim.
We did a thorough investigation of the person that prepared this diorama, and there was absolutely no evidence that he could have possibly been involved. It actually turned out that he was an artist and that he had done this as an art project.
Dr. Jensen continues the autopsy and finds a wound that sheds new light on the case.
The left hand has a sharply incised defect through the palm of the hand. It looked like it was what we would typically see as a defensive type wound, where an individual would have attempted to grab a knife, for example, under attack.
It's clear that James Madden was fighting for his life. Then Dr. Jensen discovers what ultimately killed him.
We x-rayed the skull, and there were fragments of a bullet. It was the only real tangible evidence we had into what may have caused the death. More importantly, this evidence could be recovered and examined in the laboratory to find out the identity of the bullet.
As the fragments are sent for analysis, Dr. Jensen looks for any other clues to help identify the killer.
There was a patterned injury over the palm of the right hand, which to me looked like charring or some kind of attempt to burn off the identifying fingerprints off the right hand. The external genitalia was removed. The heart, the liver, the right adrenal gland, the right kidney are gone. The skull had been fragmented. That would have allowed for the brain to be removed.
When you have a killer who has gone to these lengths, you're dealing with emotional and mental health issues as well, which makes them very, very unpredictable. And it is a much larger challenge because now you can't find what the motivation was. It wasn't money, it wasn't drugs, it wasn't sex. It was far deeper than that. It changes the entire direction of a homicide investigation.
Dr. Jensen's discoveries lead investigators to consider a chilling new possibility.
Everybody was fearful, of course, that there could be a serial killer in the area.
One of the biggest shared characteristics of serial killers is psychopathy. They lack empathy. Serial killers often get a thrill out of controlling another person. That can mean sexually, it can mean socially, and it can be done also through violence.
This was for sort of a hate after death thing. With removing vital organs such as the heart and the kidneys, these were things that didn't need to be done in order to conceal a body. This was of great concern to the police because serial killers, they keep killing unless they're caught.
To establish if they're chasing a serial killer, investigators search for crimes with identical MOs.
There were about two or three other dismemberment homicides in the country at the time. We did conduct a thorough investigation to see if there possibly could be any kind of a connection. The cuts on our homicide victim were extremely clean. They were done by somebody with a lot of knowledge about dismembering deer or a cow. A butcher, for instance, would leave very clean cuts at the joints. All of the other homicides that could have possibly been similar had horribly, terrible, torn cuts used like with a saw. There was no connection whatsoever.
The similarities were rather weak because of the different methods of dismemberment.
Unable to connect James Madden's murder to a larger pattern, investigators take a closer look at his final day.
Citizens for a Better Environment actually provided us with the route that he was supposed to follow from house to house, and we talked to individuals who had actually talked to him. And they all said he was a very nice young man, he was very polite, he came up to their house and tried to sell them magazines.
Detective Ivanovsky determines the last house that James visited.
We knew that the next house that he would go to was Mr. Dressler's house.
Investigators knock at the door of the sprawling 17-acre farm belonging to Joachim Dressler.
When the sheriff, Rohner, and myself were talking to him, he was telling us that he had no contact with anybody from anywhere and that he had not seen anybody soliciting any money or doing anything like that.
As Dressler talks with law enforcement, Lieutenant Ivanovsky studies his body language.
It was his eye movements, it was his voice inflection, it was the look on his face, it was the hand movements that he used. And when we drove out of the driveway, Sheriff Rohner and myself, we both had the same feeling. We felt in our hearts that there was something wrong. There's more to this than what he was telling us.
Investigators have a hunch one county resident is hiding something about James Michael Madden's murder.
Mr. Dressler, he was married and had two children. I don't think he was on the police radar.
I use the word hinky. He did not look like he was telling us the truth.
We knew that Mr. Dressler had admitted to being home alone. His wife and two children were not there, so there was opportunity.
Police need more to tie Joachim Dressler to the murder. They take a hard look at his life.
The neighbor right next to Joachim Dressler said that many of his dogs had been killed by Joachim Dressler, and he knew this for a fact. Another neighbor stated that they saw Joachim Dressler late at night, wandering on his property, naked, going from tree to tree and dancing through the woods. You have to be extremely careful with every one of these stories, and then you have to prove it or disprove it.
Detectives also examine his personal life.
Joachim Dressler, he worked as an elevator repairman in the city of Milwaukee. Every elevator has a closet where they have all the mechanics for an elevator. And in every one of the closets which he was responsible for were bottles of vodka. And he would drink between one or two bottles of vodka during an eight-hour shift. So Joachim Dressler was an extreme alcoholic.
As Lieutenant Ivanovsky continues to gather information, Dr. Jensen receives a surprise visit.
Very early one morning, there was an individual who came to the morgue doors and asked to see me. He informed me that he was an expert in plastic bags and that he could help me. The case by that time was in the newspapers, and the yellow plastic bags were well described in the newspaper. There's a lot of crazy people that think they're experts in things and certainly are attracted to cases like this. So that was my major concern. And so I actually interviewed him for some time.
He had been a bag manufacturer for 40 years. He had a chemical engineering background.
I showed him the plastic bags. He immediately kind of dropped to his knees and cradled the plastic bag. He examined the edges and felt the texture of the bags. And he finally stood up and looked at me and he said, "These bags are manufactured in only two places in the world, and that they are typically used for charity fundraising events."
Lieutenant Ivanovsky chases down the lead.
There was a school on the north side of Milwaukee that actually was selling these yellow plastic bags and as a fundraiser. A relative of Mrs. Dressler worked at this school, and she had actually sold yellow plastic bags to Mrs. Dressler. So now we had a direct connection of these plastic bags to Joachim Dressler.
Armed with new evidence, police obtain a search warrant for the Dressler's property.
His house was in the middle of 17 acres of property, some of which was plowed land, and some of which was wooded land, and some of which was grassland. So, this was quite an extensive search. We're looking for any trace evidence. We're looking for anything that might link Joachim Dressler to the homicide of James Michael Madden. I went down the basement. We discovered extreme amounts of pornography. All of it, for the most part, was homosexual pornography. And it was just remarkable that all of this existed in a family man's house with two little children. There was a possibility that he was living a lie.
As investigators move through the home, police uncover much more alarming material.
Some of the things that he had were snuff films, sexual films of people being murdered, and he was obviously very fascinated by this.
We discovered a hoist inside the garage. And he told us that he used it to lift motors out of cars. But it could very easily have been used to hang a body from and dismember the body in his garage.
The search continues to turn up highly suspicious items.
When police arrived at the scene, the suspect's child was out in the backyard flying a kite. And the kite was made of yellow plastic bags.
So we took the kite, we had it analyzed, and it was discovered to be the same plastic material that James Michael Madden had been found in.
Police combed through the house, looking for a murder weapon.
We did find this pistol, as well as some bullets.
There were bullet fragments found in the skull remains of our victim, but those were unable to be matched up conclusively.
However, the gun that we found was very similar in caliber to the bullet hole in James Michael Madden's head.
As detectives wrap up their search of the home, they make another shocking discovery.
One of the investigators came to me and he says, "You have to see this, of course." And so I went down the basement with him, and Joachim Drexler had a tanning booth in the basement. And if you stepped inside this aluminum shell, up above the door on the inside was written in black permanent ink, J. Period Madden. And of course, that's the victim.
As detectives gather evidence from Joachim Drexler's home, one of his neighbors shares stunning new information with police.
While he was being investigated, he talked to a neighbor, and for some reason, he told the neighbor that he had killed our victim.
That is how we ended up making an arrest of Joachim Drexler.
Police charged their suspect with first-degree intentional homicide. Only now, Joachim Drexler is trying to pass off the vicious murder as an accident.
He said that they were in the backyard shooting and that he had accidentally discharged a pistol and it shot the victim in the back of the head, and then he then just panicked, so to speak, and dismembered the body and disposed of it. That wasn't our theory of what happened, of course. We thought that he killed him deliberately. Exactly why? Was it just an opportunity that he could finally relive his fantasies, his fascination with death, and recreate it? His family was gone, and he had a number of tools that we recovered which could have been used to sever the body and cut it into pieces.
The prosecution looks to the medical examiner to show what really happened to James Madden.
He's got a defensive injury that he confronted his attacker. Then you have ligature marks, abnormal stab wounds, and mutilations, emasculations, dismemberments, and attempts to hide and sequester a body. And so it becomes an unbelievable story to connect an accidental firearm injury with the type of death that this victim experienced.
Dr. Jensen's findings clearly point to a cruel and deliberate murder. The prosecution lays out its own theory of what happened once James Madden arrived at the remote farmhouse.
Mr. Drexler propositioned our victim for a homosexual relationship. And he may have turned Mr. Drexler down, and then that may have set him off in some way.
Joachim Drexler then attacked James with a knife as the young man tried to leave.
And I think that Joachim Drexler was very drunk and became angry and shot James Madden in the head. He pulled the body into the garage, hung him from that hook, from the hoist, dismembered the body, and hid it in Racine County in several different places.
To bolster their theory, the prosecution calls on a man with a haunting tale.
We had another witness at the trial, a man named Keith Erickson, who had a very similar episode to our victim, and we offered him as what's called other acts evidence for motive for Mr. Drexler. Mr. Erickson came over to the house to look at buying a car. They both had an interest in guns, and they were shooting guns in the backyard. Mr. Drexler and Mr. Erickson engaged in consensual sex. He was taken into the garage and shown the hoist, which we believe was used to hold our victim upside down when he was attached at his ankles. Mr. Erickson said that Mr. Drexler had made reference to this device and shown it to him. Mr. Erickson was able to walk away unscathed. But when he found out what had happened to our victim, I remember sitting in the interview with him. It was a very scary interview for him, and he was, from his viewpoint, lucky to be alive, to be able to get out of there.
With all the evidence and the testimony of Mr. Erickson, the jury appears convinced of Joachim Drexler's guilt. Then, a major curveball.
When we were at trial, the Milwaukee Police Department arrested an individual named Jeffrey Dahmer.
Jeffrey Dahmer was a psychotic serial killer. He sexually assaulted and dismembered 17 young men, and was operating just 30 miles away.
Of course, the defense attorney was screaming that there is definitely a connection and that Jeffrey Dahmer probably killed James Michael Madden.
You never want to underestimate what can go wrong in a trial.
In one of the most defining cases of his career, Dr. Jensen becomes the lead medical examiner in the Dahmer case.
If the Dahmer evidence had been allowed to be introduced to our jury, it would have been, I think, a disaster. It certainly would have confused our jury, and we'd have to combat that the entire time.
It's up to Dr. Jensen to untangle the disturbing parallels between Dressler and Dahmer.
They were attempting to connect the two cases by what they interpreted as similarities. Forensic pathologists are advocates for their scientific opinions. You're not to be manipulated by one theory over another theory, and you use your evidence to corroborate and validate. I did not think that the two cases were involved because of the different methods of dismemberment and the different modalities of injury. And so it was my opinion that they were not related.
Dr. Jensen provided us with the overwhelming evidence to seal, I think, Mr. Dressler's fate. In the end, we did a 3-week trial and only took the jury 2 hours to return a guilty verdict. He was found guilty of first-degree intentional homicide while armed with a dangerous weapon.
Joachim Dressler is sentenced to life in prison.
At the sentencing, the judge made the statements what a horrific crime it was and that he'd never seen anything like this in his 20 years on the bench. James Madden was a completely innocent victim doing his job. And he went to somebody's house, and it was the wrong house, unfortunately, for him.
Still miss him. And think about what would have happened with us. What would he be like in now, his 50s?
Dr. Jeffrey Jensen did a phenomenal job. It's a tremendous sense of relief to know that all of the work and effort of all of the individuals that were involved in the investigation did a good enough job to put Joachim Dressler in jail for the rest of his life so that there won't be any more innocent victims.
I'm relieved and happy that we got it right, that the detailed examination to capture the evidence that was helpful in bringing an individual to justice.